I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
We're thrilled to present a recording from the 2016 Plantarama Symposium. The first guest speaker is Thomas Rayner, a landscape architect, teacher, and writer. He's designed landscapes for the U.S. Capitol grounds, the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, and the New York Botanical Garden. He's a leading voice in ecological landscape design. He blogs at the award-winning site Grounded Design. Without further ado, here's Thomas's presentation.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. Getting an invitation to come to Plantarama is, for a speaker, the Super Bowl of planting events. So, and a big reason is, I mean, Met Hort, I'm so grateful to everything they've done, Brooklyn Botanic Garden, but particularly Bob Hyland, whose leadership, hospitality, and attention to detail make this event just so special. So big thanks to Bob as well. So. And I'm particularly excited to be here with you. I both acknowledge the collective wisdom and experience in planting in this room is pretty vast. I'm a bit intimidated by it, to be totally honest. But I'll tell you what I do, I'll tell you what I know, and that's as good as I can do. But it's really a great pleasure to be here and talk to you about plants. Because as diverse as this crowd is, it is our plant geekiness that does unite us all. And today I really want to talk about plants, but not plants so much as individual specimens or collectibles. I think about plants as complex adaptive systems. As the world urbanizes and as we get tighter together, we're going to need plants for a lot of their functionality. But most of plants' functionality happens not as individual objects, but really as complex adaptive systems, so communities of plants. Turn this on here. The other thing I really want to kind of reflect on today is to think about, as we're thinking about the future of plants, to think about the future of plant culture, horticulture, and the direction it's currently going now, and what might lead to, I think, what could be the next renaissance of horticulture. Just as a bit of a background, so you understand my journey through as a designer and as someone interested in plants. I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama. I was a suburban kid. We lived on the edges of Birmingham. And what was great about living there when we were there was there was just so much land that was owned by U.S. Steel. They did very little to manage or keep it up. So I was surrounded by several square miles of Piedmont forest. And not even far from my house, they had these beautiful boulder field forest, which for me and a pack of irreverent boys from the neighborhood was just a fantastic place to play. So my first experience of plants were really not so much as specimens or collectibles, but it was really understanding plants in place. And plants as play spaces. I mean, to me, there was a grove of sparkleberries I remember kind of running through like rabbits. These boulder fields, which my mother would be horrified to know we were climbing on, but when we got to the top of them, I remember as a child seeing plants growing out of sheer rock and kind of how impressive that was. As someone who was not very plant-attuned young, but just to be able to see that plants were growing out of sheer rock, the heat and humidity off these boulders would be 130 degrees in the summer, total drought, and then when the rains would come, they would fill up with water, not drain at all. So drought to total anaerobic conditions, and yet they survive, they thrive. And there would be even moments on top of these granite rock outcrops where that would just light up with color. This is a Helianthus porteri, great granite rock outcrop sunflower. But even for an irreverent boy not so attuned to flowers, it was hard not to be wowed. When these things really lit up. Because we lived on the edge of the burbs and this was not our property, almost all of the land now, by the time I was in high school, was developed. And so almost all of this is housing tracts. The creek where we caught crawdads is now piped under super targets. I mean, so much of my favorite childhood play spaces are, now gone the way of a lot of things that were developed. So as an urbanite, as someone who lives in the city now, I turn to planting design to find a connection with the wild that I no longer have. And I think we'll see that more and more. I mean, the fact that the High Line is the most popular site in Manhattan, I think says a little bit about what we're longing for in our landscapes. So I became a landscape architect, went to grad school, studied with Daryl, and then was really fortunate to get a job with the landscape architecture firm Uma Van Sweden in Washington, D.C. It was a great time for me. It was early 2000s, so budgets were big, and this is a little modest summer house off the coast of Maine. But what was great was just really learning a new palette of plants. You know, in grad school, I'd learned a lot of woody species like landscape architects typically do, but this was a firm that was really using bold and daring swaths of perennials, you know, really busting perennials out of the perennial border and putting them into these landscape situations. This property, we had kind of a formal garden behind the walls, a lot of native plantings with ferns and different plants kind of along the boulders here. It was great working because we worked design build, so we were able to source things like, for this project, we had so much rock ledge that we really couldn't plant in. We found a blueberry farmer who was willing to sell us blueberry sod. He literally carve out pieces of sod the size of a pickup truck. And we just drape it over the rock, instant landscape. It's pretty fantastic. But it was an exciting time for me because one of the things I was learning is that perennials, herbaceous plants, are not necessarily these plant divas, you know, these high-maintenance ornamental plants that require constant deadheading and maintenance. Now, these were really actually very tough plants, and they were tough because we could use them in kind of landscape scale settings, not just garden settings, and they were beautiful. They were lush. They gave the landscapes a sense of seasonality. It changed every single day. So wonderful to work with Wolfgang Uma, who's just a brilliant plantsman. It was great to work with craftsmen, like this is a timber frame arbor I designed where using no nails or screws whatsoever. So you know, the ability to work with a great craftsman was a great great asset. And this is the ocean side of the property where we weren't allowed to do any hardscape, so it all had to be natural. And then, you know, working with Ben Forgey, an artist who used driftwood to create some benches. But the great thing, so I was learning new plants. I was learning new ways of using plants for me. But one of the things that I didn't really realize until I left was that when you have projects with unlimited budgets and you have projects with endless maintenance, you think you're a great planting designer. And so, you know, if a plant didn't look good, if a plant died, it was immediately replaced. Things were taken away, you know, everything was always photo ready. They were fluff, they were cut, things were edged. It was fantastic. It was a great asset. But around 2008 or 2009, I wanted to transition. I'm now working with the firm Roadside and Harwell in Washington, D.C. They do much more public scale work, which I really love. I had this kind of own steady and itch to do more than just kind of private scale work. But the transition was really hard, particularly when it came to understanding how to do horticulture in the public realm. This was a project just south of DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C., where we're installing a median. And in order for the first phase of planting, in order to stretch our budget so we could plant what we wanted to plant, we're literally using the Business Improvement District ambassadors to install. So going from projects with kind of endless trained maintenance and horticulturalists to going to projects where I'm explaining what end of a shovel goes in the ground was quite a big transition for me. And you know, this is the median installed. The other thing I'm learning kind of in the public scale is that there's just a lot of pressure around planting. I think people are understanding the value that plants can have as a piece of urban transformation. I mean, the High Line really testifies to what horticulture can do to kind of transform real estate values. And so organizations like this Business Improvement District understand that, you know, their shop owners can sell more stuff if they have a beautiful median there. And so planting in this kind of scale can't be subtle, though. You know, it's not about subtle seasonal shifts. It needs to be bold. It needs to be big. It has to be read at a vehicular scale. It has to stand up to the salt trucks that come through here. It has to look good, you know, even in the dead of winter and have a lot of winter structure. And it has to do all this in 7 feet of width, you know, so it was just increasingly a challenge. And then now the kind of challenges I see in planting designs, this is a project we're currently working on. This is a riverfront park in Fredericksburg, Virginia. Right now, most of the site is parking lots, but they really think this can be a new kind of town green for them, and it has an area along the river here, kind of a planted natural area, and then an area up top. So you can, it's kind of flat toward the top, slopes down toward the river. And on the flatter area, we're planting all kinds of, typical urban amenities, splash parks and shaded areas and paths and overlooks. But what's really interesting to me is thinking about the planting that's sloping down to the river here. This is a RPA zone, it's a protected area. But some of the things that the city council has said to us is they want this planting to be the next High Line. They want it to be a horticultural destination. They want it to use all native plants from the Virginia coastal plain. They want it to look good in four seasons. And by the way, the river floods to the top of this bank two or three times a year with scouring force, pulling everything out. So in some ways, we live in a time where we have sophisticated clients and we understand the value of plants almost more than ever before. We understand that plants can perform valuable ecological functions. But in many ways, there's more pressure on planting design than there ever has been at any time in the past. It's not about being pretty anymore. It's about being more than pretty. It's about being transformative. It's about, ecological function. It's about colors, about, being able to be photographed. And so it adds a lot of pressure. So my kit of tricks that I learned doing kind of high-end residential work won't help me here. And so much of what I was looking for was this collaboration I had with Claudia West, who is one of the more brilliant plantsmen I've ever worked with. It was one of the great highlights of my career, but we really spent 2 years trying to figure out what is the answer for places like this. How can you do planting projects for projects that have budgets to plant but don't have the know-how and the budgets to maintain and keep things going? So that was that's one of the things that's been on my mind and one of the impetuses for the books. The other thing I've been thinking about as I go around the country and speaking to different crowds is kind of the state of horticulture today. And I want to talk about kind of two declines here. I think we're seeing a bit of a decline in interest in horticulture. At the same time, we're having a decline in some of our wild spaces. You don't have to dig too far on the internet to find things like this. This was U.S. News and World Report, then followed up here. But, horticulture is ranked as one of the top 20 most useless degrees. And all over the world, there are horticultural societies and agencies who are all saying very similar things, that there is a shortage of young people interested in horticulture. This is Kenya, the U.K., United States. These are all technical reports written by botanic gardens, horticultural associations, and industries. So there seems to be a real lack of interest of people going into it. And this is England, which is probably the mecca of horticulture. What country other than England is horticulture more important? But even in England, they're calling this a crisis in horticulture, where they're having a large number of vacancies, and really the perception, particularly among younger people, that horticulture is not valuable, or that you can't make a good living, or it's only for untrained labor. So at the very moment in which planting means more than ever, at the very moment in which our cities are understanding the need for planting to do more than ever, we're having this gap of interest in people going into horticulture. And I find that very concerning. Here in America, what has been the stalwarts of our horticultural societies, garden clubs and these hort societies, whether it's Hardy Plants or others, are in general, there are clear exceptions to some of these rules, but in general, seeing huge drops in numbers. This one quote from the garden clubs of Pennsylvania have lost half their membership in the last decade. So millennials, younger people, they just don't have the time to spend in these garden clubs and societies. And at the same time, we're losing so much knowledge. So many of these organizations were the repositories of how knowledge about plants got handed down from generation to generation. And so as these things start to wither, we lose that as well. Excuse me. Wrong button here. And at the same time, as the world urbanizes, America, which is once a country with vast wildernesses and seemed like had as much nature as it could ever even imagine dealing with, is urbanizing. The whole world is urbanizing at a pace that's really unprecedented in human history. Right now, half of the world's population lives in cities, and in the next 18 years alone, 2/3 of the world's population will be in cities. So we are urbanizing at a very rapid pace. And so more and more cities and towns are all we have. So what does that mean for green? Well, obviously, plants could still exist. You know, even we know if at any moment or place in our cities, if we stop paving or mowing or doing whatever, plants would come back. They would fill in the gaps. In fact, plants have this remarkable ability to persist and live in the most unbelievable situations. So we know, even though we're urbanizing, plants can still coexist in one way or the other. In fact, it's this irrepressible spirit of particularly wild urban plants that kind of got me and Claudia thinking early on in our writing and thinking about this book. I walk down the street with my 5-year-old son to the public library several times a week. And across the street from me, this is my neighbor who is kind of the neighborhood hippie. He doesn't mow his yard almost ever. People in the county call the county to get him to come and mow his grass 2 or 3 times a year. But I remember on August afternoon, as walking down the street, I took a weed ID book out with me, and this punishing hell strip that gets nothing but salt trucks in the winter and gets stepped on because there's a bus stop down here, I counted over 25 different species growing in probably less than 20 square feet. You know, a remarkable, I mean, it's not beautiful, obviously, it's not sexy, but, you know, 25 species in less than 20 square feet. There's nowhere, anywhere in my garden has near that density and diversity of plants. And yet I keep walking down the street, and this is the public library, there's my son, but here is a rain garden, a native garden that's meant to perform a valuable ecological service, you know, to purify and clean rainwater here. But in many ways, it's very high maintenance. It uses almost all native plants, but they obviously didn't have enough money to, totally cover the planting. But I'm out there looking and watching volunteer master gardeners come out there several times a year to weed. They have to mulch it. They have to water it in the middle of summer. So here you have a planting whose sole purpose is to be low maintenance, ecologically functional, and it requires great effort to maintain. And then here is something that people have to call the local county to repress. And so when I think about these two, this irrepressible plants emerging out of the cracks in sidewalk, and then I think about a planting like this persisting only because of great care, then I think there is a real difference between the way plants grow in our gardens and the way that they grow in the wild. In our gardens, we arrange plants individualistically. We arrange plants like furniture, or we treat plants like specimens. It's hard to find a planting design book in literature out there that doesn't make the analogy somehow of plants to painting in one way or the other, as if plants are static paint chips. But in the wild, plants are social. Plants are social. In fact, everything about a plant, from its shape to when it's at seed to its root structure, is a reaction to growing to other plants. I mean, everything about this Asclepias tuberosa, the height it sets its bloom, the fact that it has a taproot meant to crack through the fibrous roots of grasses, to the timing of when it sets a seed, is all a reaction to growing out of a matrix of other plants. Plants are social. They're meant to grow together. And so in a lot of ways, when we pull plants out of these relationships, we're losing some of the potency and the function that they could have. In our gardens and landscapes, we change our sites to eliminate stress. In fact, almost everything we do as gardeners, in terms of site preparation, is really with this idea that we need to attack any stress in the yard. We want to make our plants as comfortable as we possibly can. If we have clay, we bust it up and add organic matter. If we have not enough water, we add irrigation. If we don't have enough light, we limb up our trees or cut down trees. In fact, soil preparation, I mean, everything we do around soil preparation, the idea is to make soil almost something like potting soil, a generic enough medium, neutral enough to grow any plant we want from all over the world. But plants actually prefer specific soil. They don't want generic soil. Plants really want very specific conditions. In fact, it's the stresses of a place that actually create strong plant-place relationship. This is the Sonoran Desert, and it's hard to find a more beautiful floristic plant community. When the wildflowers are in blooming here, you'd hard to find another place anywhere in the world that's more colorful than this. And these plants are here because they're adapted to this stress. So in many ways, when we make our yards kind of really generic, we make them kind of okay for a lot of plants, but we don't make them really good for some plants. And so in many ways, it'd be better to embrace the stresses of a site as an asset for creating better plant-place relationship. In our yards and gardens, we use mulch as ground cover, particularly on the East Coast, where mulch seems to be plentiful and available. And it's not that mulch is bad, necessarily. There's many, many great functions for mulch. But I remember looking, this is a project, a public park in Newark, New Jersey, that my firm had worked on. And I remember seeing this planting plan on the sheet of paper, and all the little circles for all the shrubs were touching. It looked very dense. But in reality, you realize that a lot of our upright deciduous shrubs are actually not great ground covers. You know, there's a sea of mulch underneath these plantings. In the wild, plants themselves form green mulch. They cover the ground with density and much diversity. In fact, it is plants' job to cover soil. Bare soil, particularly in our part of the world, is almost always a temporary condition. Plants cover ground is what they do. And when we don't have plants covering ground in our own gardens, weeds come in. And it's not necessarily a bad, we may not like the weeds, but it's what plants do. It's their job to cover soil. And they do that with many different strategies, and Cloudy is going to talk about some of those later on. In our gardens and landscapes, we use the work of breeders to get great horticultural color. So we get plants with, you know, stronger leaf colors than we would normally. And I love this stuff. You know, I go to the retail nursery in April and get the latest pink and purple polka-dotted heuchera out on the market. I got to have it. But sometimes you get the sense that all of this breeding work and all these kind of colors end up in these compositions that are a little bit jarring sometimes. Whereas in the wild, plant colors are harmonic. I mean, everything about native plant communities in the wild. You look at a rock, and look at it next time you're out hiking, look at the colors of the rocks and look at the colors of the plants or the bark on the trees. There's a harmony in every element, from soil to plants to color. And then you get moments in the fall where, you know, this to me is interesting, but this is soul-stirring. So I think we're missing out on a lot of things. And as more and more people are trying to do ecological planting, as you get more people trying to do rain gardens, you get elementary school moms and dads volunteering their time to install pollinator gardens at schools, and they're failing. People then start blaming the plants, as if this were the plant's fault. And it's not the plant's fault. We know this. This is how we're designing with plants. So I find things like this to be heartbreaking, and because people, when they do fail, it turns them off of plants in general, and particularly native plants. So what is the alternative? I want to just show, before I kind of get into what the alternative is, just a few images of what I think the alternative can be. I think this is the alternative, this beautiful garden designed by Dan Pearson. This is the alternative, garden designed by Sarah Price, James Hitchma in London. I think this is the alternative. This is a rose garden in Wisley, where they actually eliminated a lot of the roses and did all kinds of companion plantings to create stronger plant combinations to extend the season of bloom and to deal with some of the problems they're having with fungus and monocultures. And this is the alternative. This is a Roy Diblick design in Chicago area. Plants naturally interact. So the question that Claudia and I have in doing the book was trying to understand, how can we work with these interactions rather than fighting them? And for us, the idea was thinking about, you know, understanding the essence of a plant community and understanding how we can design plant communities ourselves, how we can create, using these principles to form our own versions of these. If you look at plant communities in the wild, one of the things that becomes immediately apparent is the fact that plant communities have a layered structure. They're layered above ground and they're layered below ground. And Claudia will go into a lot more detail about this layered structure. But, you know, one of the things you notice is that, you know, there are plants that cover the ground, the ground layer. They're mid-height plants, they're taller plants. And there's as much morphological diversity above ground as there is below. And you know, there's been a few books in the last year about roots that have come out, which is just fascinating. I think we have so much yet to learn about all the interactions and the communications that are happening with plants underneath the ground. But it'd be fascinating. So in the wild, you get things like this Artemisia growing literally out of a matrix of grasses. You know, it's not direct competition. These are plants that can coexist. Or a plant like this, a beautiful Carex grayi, growing literally right on top of an oak. You know, no mulch circles here. So in traditional ornamental planting, what we do is we mass plants because we want to see plants. Sometimes it's hard for a bunch of onesies to really stand out in a mixed landscape. But then we space plants far apart so that they don't touch. In fact, a lot of what we do as gardeners is a little bit like being the middle school chaperone at the dance, you know, taking the ruler to making sure people don't rub elbows too much. You know, if plants start touching, we prune them back, we throw mulch down in between them. And so sometimes we get plantings that look like this. So the idea of a design plant community is really a hybrid of these two systems. It's a hybrid of a natural plant community where you get this wonderful layered structure. But we're not turning our back on horticulture, you know, because this alone is not going to solve the problems. We're actually bringing wild plants into human landscapes. So in many ways, we need horticulture more than ever. We need the legibility, the massing, the attention to color that all this brings, and it combines it into this idea of a design plant community where you get some of the legibility in the upper layers and you get some of the functionality of plants in the lower layers. This is a nice example of a woodland floor planting where, again, you see, you know, it's a pumped-up version of what would happen in the wild. We're using things like, you have a mix of acerums and tiarellas and trilliums and other plants and ferns all mixed together in a modular mix. But we're making sure that some of the showiest plants, like the foam flower here, really get represented in strong, bold masses so that it still feels horticultural. It feels like a garden, not like a moment in the wild. And so much of this idea, as someone who spends a lot of time on social media, particularly with plant geeks on social media, one of the things I've noticed in the last 5 years is, you know, a real pitting of the native plant lovers against kind of the exotic and horticultural plant lovers. I mean, and like a lot of American debates, it's getting very polarized. And I find this to be so unfortunate because ultimately, I think we're all after some of the same goals, and why can't we use the best of both of these traditions, the best of what plants do in the wild, and the best of 4,000 years of horticultural history, and create some hybrids like this wonderful design by Adam Woodruff here that celebrates the layered structure of plantings, but it looks unmistakably designed. It elevates the role of designers and of horticulture as well. And the other thing this idea really does is it allows plant dynamics to happen. We're not so much concerned about that echinacea being in that spot forever. You know, we're really concerned about maintaining or managing the entire mix of plants here. So if one plant dies out, it's not the end of the world. We're managing for the whole thing. We're not deadheading one plant and giving another plant a lot of water and giving another plant some fertilizer. It's about managing the whole. But we're doing this within an aesthetic framework. So these mixtures of plants can happen within, you know, very traditional frames like hedges, like alleys, like you know, very other traditional formal elements of planting. So, moment of shameless self-promotion. We're doing kind of a high level talk here. A lot of the principles here we try to go into a lot more detail in the book. So if this feels kind of too high level, I would encourage you to look at it or check out in the library where we do go into a lot more detail. I want to finish today by really thinking about three principles, and really through relationships in creating a design plant community. And those are a relationship of plant to place, plant to other plants, and then plants to people. And the reason we have this kind of trio is because we felt like traditional horticulture is very concerned with relating plants to people. Big blooms, big color, you know, pleasing plants. And a lot of ecological planting, native planting, is very concerned with plant to place or plants to other plants. But it's really, we feel like we need all three of these relationships to create truly great planting design. So I want to go through some of those ideas. The first is this idea of relating plant to place. And by that, we mean really creating a palette of plants that are from similar habitats. They don't have to be all from the same habitat. In fact, you know, plant communities can be all native or they can be mixed as well. But to really start thinking about the landscapes that surround you, your sites, as a kind of habitat. You know, here in urban New York, there are a repetition of certain sites. You have a lot of dry shade. You have very small sites, typically. You have sharp moments of shade, and then when you do have sun, it tends to be very bright. You know, so you don't get a lot of filtered shade all the times. And then you have other sites, like rooftops, that have its own dynamics. So for Claudia and I, one of the things we wanted to do is to find inspirations in the wild. And one of the challenges is every plant community in the wild, they're so diverse. There's a million different variations of plant communities. So how do we, you know, pair natural models with our own gardens? And I think one of the things we really worked hard to do is try to simplify, to distill the essence of all the plant communities in the temperate world into kind of three large categories. For us, that was a grassland. woodland, shrubland, and a forest. And so for us, what plant community do you use is a relatively simple process. If you have an open, sunny area, something like a grassland would be appropriate. If you have a site that has some shade, but also some moments of sun, something like a woodland shrubland, where there are trees there, but the trees are not touching, they're kind of farther apart. And if you have closed canopy and full shade, then something, you know, more like the patterns of a forest make more sense. The reason we like to keep the inspiration simple is because all of these inspirations, grassland, woodland, shrubland, we all understand these at an intuitive level. I think our worry was if you get too specific, if you're trying to pair an oak hickory forest with, you know, an oak hickory forest over here in your yard with a red maple beach forest over here, you know, it really becomes a little diorama, a little Epcot Center of plant communities from all over the world. And we felt like that kind of clouded the issue. And what we really wanted to do is to come up with robust plantings, but the inspiration point be as simple and distilled and elegant as possible. So here, this wonderful visitor center here at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, you know, the rooftop here, even though a grassland never existed probably anywhere on the site, but a grassland makes a lot of sense on this open, sunny, exposed area. If you have an area like this suburban site here, this is my yard when I first moved in, along the bus route, so you have part shade. And the part shade is challenging in urban areas because you get areas either from the shade of a building or trees where you get blasted, you know, moments of really hard sun with moments of really dense shade. But there are woodland edge plants that really thrive in those kind of conditions. So we're replicating the layered patterns of, you know, shrubs in the back and kind of an herbaceous edge that you see on woodland edges. Or if you have a closed canopy, then really thinking about kind of the purest form of a forest, you know, where the shrub layer might be pushed back a little more, and you're really expressing the ground plane and the repetition of trees in the front. If you have a yard or a site that has a lot of lawn, I think one of the opportunities of finding where to put this planting is to think about reducing lawn. I'm not an anti-lawn crusader. I think lawns are functional. I have a 5-year-old who likes to kick a ball and play outside. But most American suburban yards treat lawn the way that we treated carpet in the 1970s, kind of wall-to-wall carpeting, wall-to-wall lawn. And I think lawn is so much better when it becomes more like an area rug, you know, when you have this little tiny bit there, because then it becomes defined. It becomes more like a garden space. Or here's some other examples. This is Tom Stewart Smith planting, an example from the Pacific Northwest. But what happens when lawn becomes right-sized is that the relationship between lawn and plants become that much more dynamic. I mean, in some ways, having the lawn here makes the planting that much more interesting. It's a foil for the planting, and then having the lawn, and vice versa. It works really well together. This is, I have an ugly 1950s ranch house on a road surrounded, on a property surrounded by road on three sides, but we had a little sunny area along a wedge of our property in a side yard that really, the grassland as a community of inspiration became a source of inspiration for this kind of planting. We can see other urban sites doing similar things. This is a Roy Diblick design in Chicago. It's kind of a parking circle around the Shedd Aquarium. And again, he's using, because it's so open, kind of a grassland-type planting there. Second principle is relating plants to plants. And I'm just going to kind of go over this quickly because Claudia is going to spend so much more time on this in her talk. But what we mean by that is really thinking about vertically layering compatible species. You think about seeing plants in the wild, we typically see plants more at eye level. You know, kind of we see what happens up there with the inflorescences and the flowers and the colors. We don't always pay attention to what happens down at the base of those plants. So we see kind of that, but not always that. And so what is actually happening down here is that there are a whole range of species that are not always available in the nursery, but species that hold the ground and create a functional matrix that supports these taller, more design-oriented plants from going through. And you can even see in this image, you know, tap roots going through fibrous roots and the diversity down below. And so what you end up getting is this wonderful intricacy of plants. I mean, here in an area of 2 or 3 square feet, you have phloxes mingling with geraniums and tiarellas with trilliums and dandelions, all within some wild grasses. But you get this wonderful intricacy. And notice how many different shapes the plants have. In fact, you know, if you're repeating too many of the same shapes, those plants don't interlock quite as well. One of the qualities of a great interlocking planting is that plants actually have different shapes, so they end up having this kind of morphological overlap in some of the plantings. So in our thinking about, okay, how can we take the complexity of all the layers? Every naturally occurring plant community has its own kind of layering system. How can we take this and translate this into a system that would make sense to gardeners and designers? And for us, we kind of felt comfortable with what probably is an overly simplified version. This is not scientific, but this is kind of a way of characterizing layers in horticultural language. So at the top, we have the structural layer. Those include things like trees and shrubs, and they even include tall structural perennials. The mid layer becomes your eye candy. It really becomes about these plants, these mid-height, particularly herbaceous plants, sometimes shrubs. We get these big sweeps of color or texture at different times of the year. And then the bottom layer is this ground cover layer, this functional matrix. And so if you're thinking about these layers, even though the top two layers become the most important, they're the design layers, are the ones you see, this becomes more than 50% of your plant selection. And you really need, it becomes inverse in terms of selection. So 10 to 15%, maybe 5 to 15% of plants in this layer, 30 to 60% of plants in this layer, and almost half your planting kind of in that layer. So you're moving down. Talk just quickly about these layers. Ground cover layer really becomes very important, and really because this is the layer that we are using mulch to replace. And I think part of the problem with the ground cover layer is that when we're looking out in the wild, we don't always notice what happens underneath. We look at something like the cinnamon fern, which if you look at most nursery catalogs would include ferns as ground covers, and some of them make great ground covers, but the cinnamon fern, for example, has bare bottom stems. And so it's actually more like a seasonal theme layer in this planting. You have a whole range of other species, from sedges to orchids to these climbing, clonal spreading plants that are actually functioning to hold the ground in between these plants. So some examples are sedges are really fantastic examples of plants. And it's been huge. I mean, North Creek Nursery sells a huge range of these plants. And then other plants as well. Cloud would go in a lot more detail with them. But one of the advantages of, I think, thinking about this ground cover layers, you know, a lot of our suburban landscapes, we have a lot of woody shrubs. This was a project I did with Uma Van Sweden at the New York Botanical Garden. They have a 10-acre azalea garden. Beautiful site, rolling topography, a lot of rock outcroppings. But one of the problems was everyone came to see the azaleas on Mother's Day, right? And they get the big Pepto-Bismol swirl of pink and coral. And then when the show was over, it was pretty unexciting horticulturally. You just have these kind of collections of woody species. And I would say, I mean, kind of all over our gardens, we have a lot of this issue happening here. We have kind of groups of shrubs, but very little happening underneath. So they hired us to come in and design 10 acres of plantings, perennials and grasses, to plant underneath and around the base of these plants. And what was really remarkable was not just how much more functional the planting became, but just how much lusher, how much prettier. It changed a woody collection into a garden space. And so here you see a stilbes blooming. So a lot of times we had plants that are blooming at the same time as some of the azaleas. Other plants that were giving textural contrast, like the heuchera with some of these azaleas there. Or even taking some of these wild azaleas, which are, you know, naturally very sticky and kind of upright, and underplanting them with geraniums and sedges and amsonias, all kinds of other plants to really cover the bases. And by using this ground cover layer underneath woody collections, it brought the plant, not only was it more functional, not only was it more biodiverse, but it just made it look prettier. And it was just lusher and more garden-esque, got a lot more color. This example of the Wisely Rose Garden, which was recently redone in the last couple of years, did a very similar process. They're having problems with monocultures of roses and all the funguses they were dealing with, and then ripped out quite a bit of the roses so they could add things like ligularias and nephovias and other plants. And you know, not only was it kind of more functional in terms of having more diversity, but it was more beautiful as well, extended the season of interest. Your next layer is what we call the seasonal theme layer. And if you think about plants in the wild, you get these seasonal themes. You get things like in a meadow, butterfly weed and echinaceas and different echinaceas creating seasonal themes. This is what connects us so powerfully to some of these landscapes in nature. And so Claudia will talk a lot more about how to use some of those layers in plantings. And then the last one includes the structural layer, trees, shrubs, but also structural plants like silphium in some of these plantings. And Claudia's got a great presentation understanding kind of how the different competitive strategies of these plants, particularly with structural plants, are enable it to be more interlocking and tough. So good structural perennials include things like our panicums, our veronicastrums, asclepias. So putting these together, If you think about most traditional horticultural planting, we do things more like this. So you get, you know, big blobs of individual species, of the same species, 35 Panicum here, 30 Emsonia here, you know, 25 of this there, and we block them. And the massing helps us to see. But in a design plant community, we're actually pulling these patterns apart. We're designing from the top down because we want to design the things we see first, our structural. You know, we want to get those patterns, the framing right. And sometimes these structural layers can be informal patterns. We can have alleys, we can have part-clipped boxwoods, we can, you know, or they could just be naturalistically arranged. But we're laying those out first. Then you're coming with your seasonal theme layers. If you look at the X's and triangles here, you see they're in drifts. They're still in masses, so they relate. Again, we're still using massing, but we're pulling the masses apart. And then the ground cover plants really become almost modular at this point. You're really getting a great deal of density and diversity in this layer. In fact, that's what this layer is really, since you don't see it that much, it's all about getting as many different types of ground covering plants in there as possible. It makes your planting much more functional. So some examples of Mutuccia, ostrich fern here growing, again, a plant that has some kind of bare stems at the bottom with Galium here and Epimediums. And we've all had moments in plantings where you get this wonderful interlocking quality. I mean, you can hardly get mulch inside something like this. When plantings become this interlocking, they really become incredibly stable, and there's very little maintenance that actually needs to happen at this point. Even a plant like a grass like Spirobolus, which is a great kind of low 18-inch tall ground covering plant, can be benefited from being underplanted with a plant like our native Geum fragaroides. It's a great spreading plant. You know, a lot of these ground cover plants are not plant divas. You know, these are not things that are going to make you go weak in the knee on in April to run out to the retail nursery to buy it because it's just so gorgeous. These are not hydrangeas. These are not roses. But these are functional workhorses of plants. And you know, it really pays to buy these small and as in high quantity as possible. So just an example of I love this planting by Roy Diblick and the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago. But here's a design plant community. But just seeing these layers. Here you see Carexes really forming the ground cover layer, Carex flacca and Carex brevior. And I love about the Carexes just all the different shades of colors, you know, the blue colors with the apple greens and the deep dark greens. So there's just a lot of shades of color, wide blades, thin blades you get with the sedges. But, you know, they're really not visually dominant. They really just kind of hold the ground, and they're kind of quiet in this planting. But it's a seasonal theme layer that's really making this photograph that much more dynamic. You have Allium Millennium and Salvia Cardana really forming a seasonal theme in the mid layer. But one of the things about the seasonal theme layer is all about waves of color. One thing blooming, and then the next, and then the next. So things like Nepeta Early Bird is already finished. You can see it just finishing, and this is coming in. And if you see here, the Pygnanthemum, Tenuifolium, is coming up next. So it's really about thinking about waves of color. So, you know, even though we have, you know, some happening now, there's something coming, something online, on deck coming next. And then in this planting, in addition to having some structural shrubs and trees kind of in the background, this verbascum is actually functioning as kind of a structural plant in this planting. So as a result, you get this wonderful, you know, what looks like it could be a magazine photo because you have kind of all sweeps of color, the ground cover, you have all three kind of triangulated layers together. When you're thinking about these layers, I really think if you can think about your upper layers being about design, your massing, your patterns, your legibility, and the bottom layers really become about diversity and functionality. This is a planting by Heiner Lutz in Germany, a modular planting, probably 15 to 20 different species in it. But what he's done so well is he's really mastered the seasonal theme layer. A planting that could look in this public park mixed or weedy becomes one wave of color following the next. Here we have salvias with bearded irises. You can see some dianthus coming up. I think there's some aruncus in here in the foreground. Asters, grasses, just one wave of color after the next. And so it's hugely popular and acceptable in the public because he really has understood the value in really celebrating that layer. The last principle I want to talk about is relating plants to people. And by this, I mean really interpreting and amplifying nature. I think part of the challenge of taking plants in the wild and then pulling them into our small human landscapes is a scale issue. You know, we see plants, this is the meadow at Longwood Gardens, we see plants out in the wild, or managed wild in this case, in huge sweeps in color, and it's very moving in that way. But if all we do is take a few moments of this and plop them into our front yards, you get plantings that sometimes don't always have the power of the original because they don't have the scale. This is a wonderful planting done by Marcus de la Flor. Got all the principles of a design plant community going on. He's got color, he's got layering. But there's a sense in which, you know, my mother-in-law, who loves gardens, would want to run out and take a weeder to this garden right away. I mean, she would be calling the county on this guy for this kind of planting. So there's a sense in which, you know, if you just take a little moment of this and kind of plop it here, even as functional and well done as this is, I think there's a sense in which it's really not responding to the vernacular landscape because it hasn't been pumped up enough. So I think the goal for abstracting planting is to really interpret and amplify nature, not just imitating it. So here on the left, you see two natural inspirations, a streamside planting that in this design for Chelsea Flower Show by Luciano, I always butcher his name, Goublier, maybe? Yeah. Beautiful garden, but I mean, it's evocative of this because it's got the water, the repetition of species. Even though all these plants come from places all over the world, they're all from the same types of habitat. So you feel, the planting feels emotionally like a bit of what you see here, or this wonderful collection of spring ephemerals, which, you know, you can imagine dropping this into a Brooklyn backyard, you know, and it wouldn't be that impressive. So in a lot of ways, we need to kind of pump up the volume on some of the planting, using the most floriferous species and using them in bigger patterns. The goal is really about abstracting the visual essence of wild plant communities. And I think abstraction is really the heart of all art. You see this photograph of Mont Saint-Victoire in France, and then you see Cézanne's abstracted interpretation of it. Here we see the photograph in the or the mountain in the way the artist sees it. And in many ways, it's as beautiful, if not more beautiful, than the photograph itself. The way this field and forest scene gets replicated in this painting by Wolf Kahn. In Kahn's painting, we feel the spirit, the essence of the site, even though many of the details have been deleted. And I think it's one of the principles there. We don't have to replicate every detail of what happens in the wild. In fact, sometimes we want to delete some of the details and some of the complexity of what's happening in the wild in order to make it more appealing to us. Heiner Lutz calls this the principle of dominant species. And the idea is this. If you look at any planting in the wild, if you go to this the North Woods here in Michigan, and this shown in this photograph, the ecologist plant list for this planting would probably be 20 or 30 different species. But we really don't see that much complexity. We see bracken ferns, we see some lobish blueberries and other ericaceous plants, we see sedges, the pines. So even though there's a lot more diversity in this planting than we see, it's the simplicity of the dominant species that makes it that much more appealing and legible for us. Same thing here, this birch bog in the Shenandoah National Forest. What probably has half a dozen to a dozen different species in it, we're really only seeing the sedges and the birches. And that, as a result, we recognize this kind of as an archetypal landscape, something that has more emotional power for us. I love this design done by, I think originally by Cornelia Oberlander and also with H.M. Whiteside Architects. This is the New York Times headquarter building. Just a very tiny, small urban courtyard. But I think what they've done so well in this planting is really to leave the feeling, the distilled essence of a woodland, even though this has none of the scale of a true woodland. And I would even argue that they could probably have had a lot more diversity in this ground cover layer. They probably could have another six or seven species in that if it's all the same height. And it really wouldn't have challenged the legibility of it because they've taken the structural layer and they've distilled the essence with the structural plants and the seasonal theme plants. In this case, texture becomes a seasonal theme. And they've really made it very simple. And so, you know, I think having more diversity here wouldn't challenge that at all. But it feels like a moment in the wild. And honestly, I think that's the game in planting design these days. It's not just about pretty combinations, although I think that's great. I think the game is going to be more about evoking moments in the wild and the pleasure of that evocation. I love this planting. This is a Chelsea Flower Show garden. But what's done so well in this planting is the amplification of wet textures. You know, plants that evoke a sense of woodland glade. You got, you know, big leaf plants, glossy textures, light catching deschampsias, irises. So all of the elements, even though this plant palette is very cosmopolitan, it comes from all over the world, they all come from similar habitats. So your emotional association feels like, I mean, this is a tiny garden, not much bigger than what you see here. Everything you see in this design by Charlotte Rowe feels like a moment in of the wild, which is what makes it that much more pleasurable. The last part of relating plants to people is creating orderly frames around mixed planting. I think the challenge in creating plantings that are mixed is that they can look chaotic and messy. And so a lot of ways we deal with that and make it relating to people is to think about how we deal with the edges around the plantings. This is another Heiner Lutz project in Germany, a 300- or 400-year-old house, very historic urban area. And he's taken a modular mix of plant species and in the middle, very kind of ecological mix of plants, but he's surrounded it with a boxwood parterre. And as a result of it, it looks formal. So much of what we're advocating for here today is not, I'm not peddling a style. I don't care if you like naturalism or don't like naturalism. I don't care if you like formal gardens or modern gardens or crazy wild gardens. That's not the point. The point is I think we can use the way that plants naturally interact to make any kind of style of planting better. In fact, style is more influenced by how we shape them, how we relate these carpets of these mosaics to our landscapes. This Thomas Stewart Smith planting with zinc planter looks contemporary because the frame around this is kind of a much more contemporary structure. So the way we frame these plantings has a large degree into how we interpret them in human landscapes, vernacular landscapes. So those are the three principles, relating plant to place, relating plants to other plants, and then relating plants to people. I want to just wrap up today by kind of going back to the question of thinking about why design plant communities. I think as designers and landscapers and architects, I think it's time for us to acknowledge the fact that we do live in a post-wild world. This is an aerial of the U.S. at night, and the lighted areas of the map are towns and cities, and then the dark areas are, I think, the places where we used to think nature was. Places like this, the Smoky Mountains and Appalachians. But as we urbanize, as these light areas of the map grow, we're also changing the dark spaces on the map. So these dark spaces are not just pristine wilderness anymore. More and more, the dark spaces are things like the Alberta tar sands or anyone who's flown over the Midwest. You know, we're using the dark spaces to feed and fuel our cities. So all over the world, as this dynamic happens, what this means is that nature really no longer exists apart from us. And there really is no going back. All over the world, we've replaced this and this with this and this. Now we're left in a world without pristine wilderness, only more and more cities. But the landscapes of our cities and suburbs still have plenty of green spaces in them. But these green spaces are fragments, a confetti of isolated woodlots, strips along the highways, vast deserts of lawn, and slivers of trees along drainage ditches and streams. But it really wasn't too long ago that most of us spent our time in a wild and thrilling landscape. I mean, if you think about our evolution as a species, it's only in the last 100 years or so that we've been removed from these wild spaces. We used to sleep under the stars, break the soil with our hands, and use the plants in the forest to find our way home. So I think a part of us deep down still longs for that connection. We carry with us the psychological equipment, rich in instinct and emotion, required to navigate a complex natural world. But now we live in a post-wild world. Instead of staring at the stars, the computer, or forest floor, we're staring at computer screens and smartphones. The modern world we live in requires few of the mental and physical capacities we were evolved with. And I think worst of all, there's just so little in our yards and landscapes that gives us pleasure. So little that gives us pleasure. We've projected onto yards too much of our Protestant work ethic. We mow our endless lawns. We clip our foundation plants within an inch of their lives. But do we really have yards that we yearn to be in? Do we have gardens that we miss in the wintertime? Do we fill our beds with plants that remind us of the beauty of the wild American landscape? We live in a post-wild world. But the loss of nature in the wild is not the end. And I really, truly believe that this can be a new beginning. It is time for us to look at our cities with fresh eyes and see the potential of rewilding our cities. I want to pose a question to you that my 5-year-old asks me every single day. Why not, Daddy? Why not put meadows on top of our gas stations? Why not have meadows snaking through skyscrapers? Now, what does it say that the High Line is the most visited site in Manhattan, a site that is a relic of a spontaneously occurring urban meadow, is the most visited site in New York? What does it say about what we want? Why not have elevated roads covered with connected forest? And why not construct wetlands, not chemical treatment plants, to purify our drinking water. All of these things are possible. All of these things are happening. But we'll only reach this vision once we understand that nature is not this pristine thing that exists apart from us. What I love about the idea of a design plant community is that it is optimistic. It looks at cities around us and sees not the end of nature, but a new beginning, a hybrid of the natural and the man-made. Nature and cities can coexist. Whether we choose to acknowledge it or not, we are all responsible for each other and the places we live, which is exactly the way it is because, unconsciously or consciously, we have made it so. And while none of us govern the rules that made the rules that govern our cities, we do make the rules that govern our hearts. And I believe within each of our hearts, there remains a very real and mysterious yearning for the wild, a yearning for an encounter with nature. We feel this when we walk into our gardens in the morning and feel the dewy mist in our skin, or discover a cocoon in our garden, or see how the grasses look back lit by the sun. Folks, I think the time is right for a renaissance of horticulture. I think more than ever, we need horticulture. More than ever, we need planting solutions that are resilient, functional, and beautiful. I think design plant communities require an ecological understanding of plants, but even more than that, they need horticulture. They need a renaissance of what you know, what you specifically know. They need designers with an eye for combination, a flair for color, and an intuitive sense of natural harmony. They need gardeners who can find a place to plant, even in the most unlikely places. And they need plant lovers who understand that we don't need to go to a national park to have a spiritual experience of nature. We can have them on our own backyards, parks, and rooftops. I truly believe the next renaissance of human culture will be the reconstruction of nature in our cities and suburbs. And gardeners and designers, not politicians, will lead this revolution. And plants will be the center of it all. Thank you very much.
For listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.